And we have a split show for you tonight. So we've got Neil Slade this hour with your phone calls about the brain, about imagination. Check in with us. Next hour, Paula Harris joins us, a breaking story about giants. And, of course, her latest, UFOs. How does one speak to a ball of light? Looking forward to that, too. We'll be back with your calls in a moment with Neil Slade on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back, Neil Slade with us. Neil, that announcement makes me wonder about memory itself and how that works. And you can perfect it. You can make it better. Whereabouts in the brain does the memory lie?
Well, memory, again, imagination and memory, it's all over the place. Because memory and imagination are, they're multifaceted. So you can't really just pinpoint one section of where memory is happening as well. But if you'll beg my indulgence just for about 30 seconds here, I wanted to finish up what I was saying about Julia Liu.
Your wife.
Yeah, and you know, it's not important that I married her. That's nepotism. What? Julia has got, she is a bona fide genius. She has got a PhD in science, and then she went on to become a lawyer, and then she started oil painting. And what was happening was, is years ago she was having all of these extraordinary paranormal experiences, like remote viewing in China, like seeing her dead father, and all these things that were proven. And so she started listening to Coast, because she thought maybe she'd get some answers. And that's how we met. Now, Julia is maybe the most creative person I've ever met in my life. She's done thousands of oil paintings. And along with all this paranormal stuff, I made her write a book about it because I knew somewhere she understood, maybe it was not analytical like I do, but in her gut, she knew what the connection between creativity and paranormal and prolific creativity was all about. So her book that she wrote is called Creativity from Another Dimension, and I combined it with one of my more recent books called Brain Magic 2. So that's the connection.
That's a good idea, by the way, because you know, I was looking at hers, and then I flipped over and I was looking at yours.
Yeah, well, when I was talking about whole brain, she's very right brain. She works from the gut, from the enteric nervous system. She doesn't necessarily know, you know, she knows what tickling the amygdala is, and that was one of the reasons why she transcribed that book to Chinese. But she's real right-brained, and she's real feeling. And I'm kind of the opposite side. I mean, I do know what right brain is, and I'm a musician, but I'm very analytical, and I'm very verbal.
I'm probably more right-brained as well.
Yeah, so we're a good match for each other because we balance each other out. And that's what you want to look for when you're trying to improve your brain function and get into all these, you know, since she spontaneously and naturally had all of these paranormal abilities and functions, I could look, I mean, she's been the best brain subject I've had for years.
Yeah,
you know,
that's right. Right there.
She comes at things from a completely different direction that I come from. And so that's why I think that book is really, you know, if I do say so myself, it's a really good book because it balances two different ways of looking at the brain and looking at creativity and the paranormal stuff besides.
Neil, when the physical body dies and the brain dies with it, yet we believe in life after death. We believe in consciousness. We believe in the ability to do that. How then does that function without the brain?
Boy, I don't know how it does, but it certainly does.
Yeah, I think so.
You know, you've had an out-of-body experience that you talked to me about for Tickle Your Amygdala.
Yep.
For that book, right?
Yep.
Where you floated above your body.
11-year-old kid.
I had that. You know, when Julia, one of the experiences, this is a pretty interesting story. She was taking a nap one afternoon. She went into bed, and the next thing she knew, she was back in China. And she was at the railroad station in her hometown, 10,000 miles away, and the railroad station has a clock. And she looked at the clock, and it said 2 o'clock, but it was dark out. So she thought to herself, oh, it must be 2 a.m., because it was noon when I went to sleep in Columbia, Missouri. And if it's 2 a.m. in China, if it's 2 o'clock in China and it's dark, so she looked around, and she saw two new buildings there that she didn't recognize. And she said, oh, I must be dreaming. And wait, my grandmother said, if I don't know if I'm dreaming or if I'm awake, if I bite my finger, if it hurts, I'm not dreaming. And if it doesn't hurt, I know I'm dreaming. So she went to bite her finger, and then she realized she didn't have a finger. And then she looked down, she realized she didn't have a body either. She was completely out of her body. And as soon as she realized that, she flew over the clouds, and within 2 seconds, she was back in Missouri. And then she sat up in bed, right? So she experienced consciousness without a body. And she called her sister and actually asked and described the buildings. And her sister said, oh, yeah, those are the two new hotel buildings that they just put up. And Julia had no idea. So she was able to confirm that she had actually seen something there without knowing about it or without being there. So she had real consciousness without a body. And, of course, there are so many stories about reincarnation out there. I mean, thousands.
Oh, endless.
Yeah. So I certainly can't tell you how it works, but, you know, from our own personal experience here and from the records out there, we know that the mind exists without the brain and without the body. But, you know, in this lifetime, we have a brain. And so it's good to know how the physical machinery works, you know, when you've got it. If you've got a body, if you've got a brain, know how it works, and it will serve you well, much better than if you're in total ignorance of how your brain and how your body works. You know, it's like driving a car. Somebody's got to tell you, look, here's the gear shift lever, and if you go here, you'll need first gear and second gear, and here's the brake, and here's the clutch, and make sure to put gas in the tank, which goes here, right? You got to know, in this lifetime, when you've got the body, like a car, you got to know a few basic things. And so that's what I teach people is brain basics, so you can drive that brain more efficiently. Just like, you know, if you know a few things about your car, you can drive your car better.
Good point. Let's take some calls here, Neil. Let's go, first of all, west of the Rockies. Willow is in Mendocino County, California. Hey, Willow, thanks for calling.
George.
Hi.
Hi.
How you doing?
I'm fabulous.
Good.
I'm a longtime listener, and I just love you, and thank you for everything and all the information that you put
welcome.
Out.
Very welcome.
I just wanted to touch base on imagination in your brain and getting to that point. For me, I have lived a crazy life and have gone through many leaps and bounds. And people, I feel like, don't take a time out in this life to process and let go of everything that's been done to them, said to them, and taught to them. And for me, my imagination, I'm a visionary artist, and I can walk into a room or see anything and see what it could be. And I just wanted to share that, is letting go of everything that we've been taught and letting all that hurt, the hurt and pain in your life that's happened. So, George, I could talk to you about a million things.
Well, that's very important. I think there are very famous people that we know that did exactly what you're describing in order to find solutions to problems. They would deliberately just kind of let everything go. Now, Edison, who was one of the most prolific and successful inventors of all time, he would deliberately take a nap where he just deliberately didn't think about it, and he'd go to sleep. And he did this deliberately to invoke his imagination through his problem-solving dreams.
Well, he was very smart about that.
Yeah, Beethoven would do the same thing. He might want to work on a symphony, but would he just sit in front of his piano and desk? No. He'd put on his coat and his hat, and he'd go for a walk in the woods. And removing himself from all the hubbub of the city life and the noisy neighbors and the bill collectors, he'd go out in the woods to get away from it all, and that's where he found his inspiration and his ideas for all of those beautiful symphonies. So you're right on the money there.
Remember the old saying, I can't sleep, my brain won't shut down. What does that mean, Neil?
Oh, well, I think we've all experienced that when our brain is just going a mile. We get into bed and we want to relax and fall asleep, but we can't because the brain won't shut down. So, you know, one of the cures for that kind of thing is very simple. It's physical exercise. You'll sleep much better. You'll be able to relax at night when it's time to go to sleep if you get that physical exercise during the day. And the best time for that is in the afternoon, as research is now showing.
For a nap?
Well, no, for physical exercise.
And what about a nap?
I take naps. Some people do very well. I'll get into bed at 4 o'clock for an hour.
Siesta time.
Yeah, and let me tell you, man, it's as good as I would imagine the best drug would be.
You know, in the Middle East, Neil, they will break for lunch and a nap around noon, come back around 3-4 o'clock, and then they'll work later into the night. But they've done that historically.
Now, I'm kind of like that myself. I think we have a society where people are driven far greater than they should be. And I think that one of the main reasons is we're kind of brainwashed into this materialism. So we work very, very hard. We overwork. And even if we get all that material stuff, we're not happy. Japan has the highest suicide rate of men in the world. And they are a very, very work-driven country. And that's a country where the culture and the society needs to learn those lessons of siesta and nap and break. And all of us would do much better if we just kind of took our foot off that accelerator pedal a little bit.
Sip the wine and smell the roses.
Yeah. That's exactly.
Let's go to Paul in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, east of the Rockies. Hey, Paul.
Yeah, how you doing, George?
Good. Hi,
Neil. I got a question. Your third eye, to where you can see pictures and you can hold them and see that picture for a while. Well, mine is like, I don't know, it's not there. It hasn't been for a few years, and I was wondering if there was any kind of exercise or anything to get that back.
Oh, yeah. My books are all about that, but I can give you a couple good ones right here. One of the things to really get your creativity and imagination going is my most basic brain game, and I call it tickling the amygdala. And what you do is you imagine that you have a feather inside your head, and you've got two little amygdala buttons, and what they do is they kind of make the energy go forward into your frontal lobe, so you can, you know, feel pleasure and you can feel positive emotions and you can have a good creative imagination. Now, from time to time, I've heard from a good number of people who say, like you, I can't imagine a feather inside my head, right? So you take a little baby step. And the what you do is you get yourself a real feather. You go to the toy store, or you break open one of your down pillows, or sometimes you find, you know, feathers at the park from birds, right? You get a real feather, and you hold it up in front of you, right, with your eyes open. And you take that feather, and then you brush it on your forehead, and then you brush it on the temples, right, where that amygdala would be, keeping your eyes open, right? So then you can do the same thing and watch yourself doing it in a mirror. So you can see yourself holding the feather and see yourself tickling the outside of your skull. And then what you can do is you can kind of close your eyes a little bit, right? And then eventually you do that for a week with your eyes open, and then you start to close your eyes. And what you'll find is that you'll retain that memory, and it will have triggered that ability to imagine with that third eye. Another thing you can do is, while you're doing it with your eyes open, play a piece of music, okay? And so your brain will then associate that piece of music with the vision, with the visual of that feather. And then at a certain point, you'll be able to play that piece of music, and it will then trigger that visual imagination to happen within your brain.
That works. Let's go to Charles in Baltimore. Get you in here. Charles, go ahead.
Yes, how you doing?
Good, Charles.
I'm really enjoying the program.
Thank you.
Explain the fact that I'm totally blind and I'm congenital, you know, I've never seen a day in my life, okay? And that part of my brain has not developed. No, we're not all Stevie Wonder. The average blind person is not Stevie Wonder or Ray Charles or Ronnie Millsap or Fanny Crosby. You know, Fanny Crosby, you get the picture, I think. And, you know, that part of my brain has never developed. So if I ever got sight, my brain wouldn't know how to handle it because, it just never developed. Explain that to everybody, the part of the equation.
Well, a couple things occur to me. One was that, now this isn't people who are born blind, but they do know that people who have an injury to their occipital lobe, and that's the visual part of the brain, in the back of the brain. If they have that part damaged, they can still have a visual imagination in their brain. The destruction or the injury to the occipital lobes and the visual part doesn't impair their visual memory and their visual imagination. But you also have to realize, too, that imagination isn't limited to visuals. You can imagine a smell. You can imagine hearing a piece of music. You can imagine a solution to a problem. So as I said earlier, imagination is multifaceted. And so you're not, you know, if you want to get your imagination working, it doesn't matter that you don't have a visual imagination. There's all kinds of imagination. One interesting thing that I've learned is that when you imagine something, the same part of your brain lights up as if you are really dealing with that thing in physical reality. For example, and we'll use the smelling a rose example. If you smell a rose, a certain part of your brain lights up with activity. There's more activity in a certain part of your brain responsible for smelling, in the olfactory system, in the olfactory nerve, and in other parts of your brain. If you imagine, only imagine that you're smelling a rose, the same part of your brain lights up. And they found that this is true with all kinds of things. If you are a runner and you're running, a certain part of your brain responsible for moving your legs and running will show activity. And if you imagine that you're running, the same part of your brain will light up. So it's very interesting. And it also explains how when you practice something with your imagination only, you show benefits in the same way that if you actually did that activity.
Neil, we're going to come back and take some final phone calls with you in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. I want to thank all of you who have been taking a look at our television show, Beyond Belief. You can do that yourself, 10 days free. Simply go to coasttocoastam.com, click hosts at the top of the page, and the TV icon opens up, and there you are. Have a look, and our next program will be tomorrow, 7 o'clock Eastern Time. Hope you enjoy. And welcome back with Neil Slade. Neil, you're not too far from Boulder, are you?
No, I can see it from here almost. On my roof, I can.
We got to get you on our TV show.
I would love, I just was listening about that. I wasn't aware. Would love to do it.
Tape them on Sundays in Boulder.
Hey, count me in.
Once a month.
I'll bring my wand.
You do that. Okay, let's take some more final calls here. We'll go to Los Angeles. Sean, you've been on hold for a while. Thanks, Sean. Go ahead.
Yes. Hi, George. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have one question for Neil. What would you recommend for people who have complex PTSD?
Oh, boy. There was an exercise developed at the Brain Lab, and I think I know what you're talking about. Your post-traumatic stress, right?
Yeah, it would be a complex version, so that would be like more repetitive stress through like a longer period versus PTSD would be like single-ice stress.
Yeah, sure. There was an exercise that was developed at the Brain Lab called self-trauma drama, But I made what I feel were some improvements to that, and I call it mind movie rewrite. And what you basically do is you reprogram the brain, and you teach it positive memories to replace the negative memories. And that will in turn then change the way that you react to certain situations and get you kind of break that kind of vicious cycle that you're in. And I write about that in the Frontal Lobe Supercharge and in a couple of my other books too. But it's kind of a stepped up version of the Janov. I wouldn't say primal. It's kind of like Primal Scream. I'm sure you've heard of that type of therapy. But this one really deliberately sets out for you to discover those memories and repressed memories that you still have in your brain, and then to very gently guide yourself to replace them with positive imagery and positive memories, and eventually all those kind of traumatic triggers will fall by the wayside. So there definitely is something that has been shown to be effective in that type of situation.
All right, okay. There you go, Sean. Thanks. I hope that helps you. What do you think of neurosurgeons, Neil?
Oh, I talked to a couple for the I talked to one for the Tickle Your Amygdala book. I don't know a lot of neurosurgeons. There are some that I've heard say some things that I really disagree with. And I won't name any names, but they will. I've heard some neurosurgeons say things like, we use all of our brain all of the time, which is patently absurd. And it sounded more to me like a book-selling gimmick. But then there are some neurosurgeons who would, you know, really disagree with a statement like that. So I don't think you can kind of lump them all together in one category, and they're going to, you know, neurosurgeons are going to come in all different flavors and sizes and shapes, just like the rest of the population.
Let's go to Chuck, Austin, Texas. Hey, Chuck, go ahead. You're on with Neil Slade.
Good morning. I was just wondering, what would you say, like, for myself, I'm both dyslexic and left-handed, so is there any good research about dyslexia and what actually causes it?
Well, you know, these are ailments that may be seen as a handicap, but if you are so persuaded, you may see them as a benefit. It's kind of the label that you put on things. A friend of mine, Stan Romanek, who's known for his extraordinary UFO experiences, is dyslexic, and that may be one of the reasons that he is so well equipped to handle the stress of those kinds of events. He has a handicap that has benefited him probably in some way. So some of us are left-handed, some of us are right-handed, some of us are more attuned. It's like I was explaining before about how my wife Julia does things that are completely opposite than me. So perhaps you have a problem with reading through your dyslexia, but maybe the approach, although you can deal with it, maybe a better starting point would be to ask yourself, why is this a benefit to me? Imagine how your life would be different if you didn't have that happening. It's a matter of, you know, are you going to see the glass half empty
or half full?
And use that as your starting point. And then you're not battling it. You're just kind of working with it. You're accepting it. And that's a much better starting point in terms of dealing with any kind of thing like that.
Partly cloudy or partly sunny, Neil.
Exactly right. It could be opening up doors for you that if you didn't have a problem with the dyslexia, you wouldn't even know about.
What is it about music, Neil, that puts people in certain kinds of moods?
Oh, music is just the universal language. It's one of those rare things that everyone can communicate, no matter what culture you are from, no matter how old you are. Music is something that we all share in common. We may not all like the same kind of music, but we all understand music, and we all benefit from music. And it's just something that goes way, way back in human culture. A very interesting study that I had heard about had to do with the perception of certain scales and tonalities. And we tended to think for a long time that a piece of music that would be in a minor scale, for example, would be sad, and something in a major scale would be happy. And what one clever researcher decided to do was to go to a very primitive culture, and I don't recall, I believe it was he went into the jungles in the Amazon, and these were people who had never, ever been exposed to Western music, much less major or minor scales. And they played a minor scale to a person who had never even heard a piano before and asked them, is that happy or sad? And this primitive person said, that's sad. And when he played a major piece of a major scale, he said, that's happy. So there was something genetic in this person's brain that had nothing to do with what he learned, what he had heard before, something intrinsic in music that expressed emotion and communicated a feeling that that primitive person, completely removed from our modern society, still had in common with us who are brought up and lived in the modern society. So music goes beyond what we know. It's just something that's, you know, it's a whole different level of experience that's universal between not only people, but I believe something that even animals might share with us as well.
Okay, let's go to Chubbuck, Idaho West. John's with us. John, go ahead.
Thank you, George, so much for taking my call, my phone call. This has been a very uplifting program, and I have a question for Neil. Neil, I was involved in a car accident in the early 80s, I hit my head, and I was very lucky. The doctor said a couple inches lower, I would have hit my temple, and I wouldn't be talking right now. But my question is, I do have a brain scar, and I have I'm really happy to hear what you said about the neurologist, because I've always been going fist to fist, not physically, but verbally, with these neurologists. And you know, it is evident that these scans have shown up a brain scar, but it also seems to have inhibited my creativity, whether it's writing or getting back into film. And my question for you, sir, is that my mother recently passed away last year, and she had dementia. And sometimes, I'm 54 years old, I sometimes think that, you know, is it the combination of I'm possibly getting, you know, the physician told me that you may be a candidate, you and your brother may be a candidate for this. And I worry sometimes that if the combination of the brain scan that shows the brain scar and the pop that my mom had dementia, I sometimes worry there's something you could suggest, some type of exercise or something that could help me get back where I want to, you know, don't feel so lethargic. And I just, that's why I really wanted to call and ask.
No, I understand what you're saying. Well, the brain is very plastic. That's the term that they use these days.
Plastic?
Plastic. Other words, it's very moldable. It can change its shape. And we know that the brain has tremendous ability for renewal and recuperation. Research shows us more and more that things like dementia, even Alzheimer's, are preventable and not necessarily, you know, it's not just genetics. In other words, you can change your brain depending on how you use your brain. And the brain, in a lot of ways, is just like a muscle. The more you use it, the stronger it grows. And we can see through brain scans how people's brains change at any stage of life, even if they're 80 years old, even if they've had terrible accidents and damage, you can rebuild your brain, and it's never too late. And, you know, it's just a matter of deciding that you're going to make your brain work better and then go about all the different ways that you can do to, you know, help your brain grow and become more healthy. And, you know, that's kind of what I've been, you know, dedicating myself to and writing about for these past 30 years.
So, what are some brain foods, like blueberries?
Olive oil, you know, I was investigating a doctor, and his name escapes me right now because I've only read about him very briefly. And he was talking about what are good brain foods. One of the things that you want to avoid is saturated fats and trans fats. This is not good for brain health. And we're talking about animal fat products. Keep those at a minimum. Olive oil is very good for the brain. Exercise, physical exercise is good for the brain. So in terms of food, you know, avoid what you know is junk food. Very moderate use of animal fats and high saturated fats. Olive oil is very good.
I hear walnuts are good.
It's funny. Walnuts are funny because they look like little brains. And
yeah, they do.
My wife is Chinese, and one of the things that Julia talks about a lot is having a diet that's got a lot of color in it. And when she goes shopping, she says, I'm shopping for the color diet. I want to have some blue food and some yellow food and some black food and food of all different colors. And if you find that you're doing that, you're finding that you have a great selection of food. And I don't mean colored M&Ms, right? We're talking about naturally colored foods of all different diets. And that will tend to be really good for your brain. So, those are kind of some general rules for good brain nutrition.
How soon do you see a difference when you start eating the right way?
Oh, listen, you can eat some junk food and you can feel terrible an hour later. So, what you want is long term. You want to make changes long term and not be too concerned about how fast you're going to see results. But, you know, I think when people start, you know, eating healthily, they're going to see that their brain is working better, you know, in a very short period of time. I know, for example, and I think most people will agree, if you eat a heavy meal, right, if you eat junk, you know, you just know within a very short period of time that, you know, my brain just isn't working the best that it can be.
And you know it.
Expand that over a long period of time, and it will hold true as well.
East of the Rockies, Diane in Ontario, Canada. Hi, Diane. Go ahead.
Hi. I'd like to make some comments. The last time I talked to you, I didn't make it to Toronto. And I was, like I said, I was in a 9-year walking coma. I've had so many head traumas, neck, nerve. I've been understanding it more thanks to your show and your guests,
very
George.
Good.
And my one question I had was the amygdala.
Uh-huh.
I believe, like, from severe, I was going 40 miles. I don't know how fast the guy was who hit me. The right head of my head smashed, and it's like I had no brain function. When I heard that you can make new connections in your brain, that gave me hope. Like, I used to picture everything in color. I lost all that. I tried to tell doctors, neurosurgeon, like, you have to kind of, like, they don't understand or have time to hear everything, but I had like a healing, so it kind of like restored peace. Slowly, sense came back, but that amygdala where I imagined it,
yeah,
it's like all of a sudden one day, and this is after 9.5 years, I swear it was like I can only try to explain, like my baby finger, a bit smaller, something kind of curved like that.
Yeah.
Kind of where your ear is, in the middle of my head, something, boom, sprang up like, and it was going boing, boing, boing.
No, like I'm looking at a picture of the amygdala right here, and it's exactly what where you described it. That's also connected to a spiral part of the brain in the limbic system, in this curlicue type of thing. And if people are interested in knowing what the amygdala does and what it looks like and where it is, go to brainradar.com, and if you, there's a list. There's an index on my main page, and you can see a link. It says, where's the amygdala? And you can actually go and look at a picture. But it's interesting that you had that sensation that you...
I'm telling you, like, because inside my head, for years, it was like I had a steel helmet, and I kept saying to try, like, those knights in shining armor. So I tried to say, okay, open it up, like, yeah. No circulation.
And then what, it clicked open for you? It just...
Honest, yeah. And then after that, slowly, I guess, like, now I know... I go to acupuncture, and he's bringing circulation. I've had a few other injuries, but this man is saving me years.
Yeah, I've talked to both chiropractors and osteopaths, and they integrate deliberate stimulation of this amygdala to bring forth a positive movement of energy within the brain. And one osteopath named Tom Myers in Brussels, Belgium, he discovered that through his cranial manipulation, he was tickling people's amygdala from the outside of the head. And so, and they were reporting to him all of these things that they were experiencing in terms of positive emotions and creativity. And he knew it was happening because he didn't explain to people what he was doing with this extracranial manipulation. But then they would come back in a week and say, you know, Tom, all these things started happening. What are you doing? And it was a very interesting, you know, study, and he's doing further research into that. But I completely know where you're coming from, to suddenly kind of feel that amygdala tickling forward. It's like the big light bulb goes off in the brain, you know?
Sure does. Neil, we're out of time, but once again, always a pleasure talking with you, my friend.
Thanks, George. This has been great, and I really love talking to you, too.
And if you haven't had time, just go up to Neil's website, which you can find at coasttocoastam.com. In a moment, Paula Harris joins us with some breaking news about Giants. We'll be right back.